The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Welcome. My name is Susanna Sakodu. I direct the War Crimes Research Office here at the law school and teach seminars in related areas. We run a war crimes speaker series. You might have been at our event in February where we worked with the Dutch government to put on a full-day conference on the prosecution of sexual and gender-based violence. That was February 1st. Our next event, I'm very excited to present to you Claire Duffy, who is the current monitor of the Khmer Rouge Tribunal in Cambodia. And I think she's been there 2, 3, 15. Yeah, a little over a year, monitoring the work of the tribunal at some very exciting times. There have been some very exciting developments at the tribunal, some worrisome and some not. She has 10 years of practical legal experience, including as prosecution appeals counsel with the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, and she was a federal prosecutor in Australia before that. We could say a lot more, but I want us to use this time to learn about what's happening in Cambodia and at the Extraordinary Chambers. She's quite an interesting chart behind her that she will walk you through, but let me just join me in welcoming Claire today.
Thanks a lot, Susanna, and thanks for the invitation to come and speak to you today. In the given time that we have, I really propose to do three things. The first thing is I want to outline a little bit about the court's mandate and the court structure, just so that we all know what we're dealing with here. I'm going to let you know briefly about what OSJI's role in all of this is. I'm then going to talk a little bit about the court's caseload and where all of that's at. And then the third thing I want to do is to draw your attention to some of the most recent analysis that we have given on the court in the form of a report that we just put out in early February. So the first thing is the Khmer Rouge Tribunal, or the Extraordinary Chambers in the Courts of Cambodia, its formal title, has been established now for about 5 or 6 years. It's been operational. This was actually a rather ambitious initiative, a joint initiative by the Cambodian government and the United Nations. I say ambitious firstly because this was the first official recognition by a UN-backed court for crimes that had taken place now over 30 years ago. So it was ambitious in that respect. Secondly, it was ambitious because it's the first hybrid tribunal, as they're known, that has a majority of national participation, particularly in terms of the judiciary. The jurisdiction of the court I put up here, but the crimes took place between 1975 and 1979, and the court's founding documents limit prosecutions to that specific time period. So that is the period when the Khmer Rouge was in power in Cambodia. They have a personal jurisdiction limitation, and what that means is, unlike the Rwanda Tribunal and the Yugoslav Tribunal before it, where it was just the term that was used was just persons responsible for international crimes, eventually that was narrowed, but this court started off with a more narrow definition of who it could actually pursue, and those are either senior leaders of Democratic Kampuchea or those most responsible for the crimes committed during the regime's rule. This particular part was actually put in. There are similar terms in the statute for the Special Court for Sierra Leone. And I think that actually after a number of years of the ICTR and ICTY being in operation and the caseload being quite large, and the cost associated with that also being large. When people got together and were thinking about these hybrid tribunals, they wanted to narrow that for efficiency and also cost reasons. The subject matter jurisdiction of the court is both international and national crimes, again like this Sierra Leone tribunal. The international mandate is typical for these international courts, and a few national crimes there as well. The court itself is embedded in the Cambodian national court system. What's interesting about that, and again ambitious, is that after the Khmer Rouge fell from power, there were literally about 17 lawyers left living in Cambodia. Even to today, there are very few judges, although this is very much growing now, but certainly after the Khmer Rouge fell from power, the situation was quite dire. So because it's a hybrid tribunal, and as I said, with a majority national participation, and the negotiations for the court, you know, towards the court's establishment actually took years and years for the UN and the government to reach an agreement. Originally, the UN's position is that it wanted to set up a tribunal like the Rwanda or the Yugoslav tribunal. For various reasons and through very difficult negotiations, that didn't happen. It then went back to the table with a special court for Sierra Leone kind of model, where the UN, the internationals, would still be majority, and the Cambodian government didn't agree to that. And so what happened is that a number of very complex provisions were built into the court's founding documents to try to overcome concerns about the court's independence if it was more national than international. So I've just outlined here that you have the Office of Co-Prosecutors and the Office of Co-Investigating Judges. I should have mentioned that it sort of follows a civil law system, although it's actually more complicated again than how a traditional civil law system works. But a decision about who to prosecute in the other courts, of course, just comes from a prosecutor, similar to what happens in the national jurisdictions that I'm sure most of you are aware of. But with this court, first a preliminary investigation is conducted by two prosecutors, one national and the other international, and they decide whether or not to refer what's called an introductory submission to the Office of Co-Investigating Judges. And because there is only one of each here, and there may be splits in opinion about that, they have what's called a disagreement process, where this disagreement actually goes to the pretrial chamber, and there are all kinds of rules I won't go into about resolving that. This chamber here, the pretrial chamber, is a review body for the decisions of the Office of Co-Investigating Judges. So it has a very special jurisdiction. It's not pre-trial in the sense that we would all think of as pre-trial. It's specifically related to decisions taken by this office. So the case would travel from here to here and then be reviewed here. And then after all that review is over, a case starts with the trial chamber and eventually ends with appeal. These two offices have, as I said, a disagreement process for resolving disputes, but these three chambers have what's called a supermajority requirement for their decision making. And that essentially means that even though the nationals are the majority in each of those chambers, one international has to vote with the national judges in order to make a decision. There has to be, for example, four. It can be three nationals and one international, or two internationals and two nationals, but that's how they seek to overcome splits in the court along national or international lines. You also have the Office of Administration, and within that you have the Defence Support Section, the Witnesses Unit, the Victims Unit, the financing of the court, etc. And actually the immediate Office of Administration. So that's an outline of the court and how it works. What OSJI is doing, we've had an office in Cambodia for 7 or 8 years now, I think. I've only been there for 15 months. I came straight from the Rwanda tribunal. My predecessor was there for 5 years before me. In the beginning, our office was focused on all of, the establishment of the court, but also providing technical assistance to the court in the form of capacity building, etc. Now I would say we are almost exclusively a monitoring and advocacy office. We monitor, I was just saying this morning that the focus of our monitoring is really, it's institution-wide rather than monitoring the day-to-day proceedings. There are other monitoring organizations who are there monitoring the proceedings as well, but really for reasons to do with the structure of the court, we've been focused much more standing back and looking how it's operating as an institution. There are four cases before the court. The first one has just finished. Case one was against a single accused who was the prison commander of Tol Sleng Prison, which is in Phnom Penh. That prison, in his position, he oversaw the execution of about 13,000 people in that prison. He was found guilty at trial in July of 2010. Essentially, he pleaded guilty to all of the offences he was charged with. But in the civil law system, there isn't really a mechanism for pleading guilty as we might know it in the common law system. And so it was still about 8 months of proceedings before he was actually found guilty and sentenced. The second case, which got underway late last year, is against three alleged former senior leaders of the Khmer Rouge regime. They are all in their 80s. They are amongst the only known surviving leaders of the Khmer Rouge regime. Of course, several of them, including Pol Pot, have died since and couldn't be brought to trial before this court. Originally, that case was actually against four individuals. The bottom one here, who is Yeng Tarit, is actually the wife of Yeng Suri. But late last year, she was found mentally unfit to stand trial. She has advanced dementia. And I will, in a few minutes, I'll go into some issues around that. But for now, and actually for the duration of case two, it's only against three individuals. The interesting part on the board here is that there are two other cases known as case three and four, and really this is probably the single issue that's divided the court the most. Those five suspects are currently before the Office of Co-Investigating Judges. They were referred in about late 2008 by the international co-prosecutor alone then, so not joined by the national. He referred the five suspects for investigation. His national counterpart disagreed with that, but eventually it worked its way into the Office of Co-Investigating Judges. What's important to know is that the Cambodian government, and in particular the Prime Minister, has been very vocal about its opposition to those two cases. That has been the position for a number of years now. And the government says that the risk is that the country will fall into some kind of civil war if any cases beyond case two are pursued. So they went before the Office of Co-Investigating Judges. Throughout the course of last year, we were monitoring that situation, and we raised pretty serious concerns about the lack of investigation in those cases. The case three investigation was actually closed in April of last year by both a national and an international judge acting together. I think for the most part, the reasons as to why the international judge acted with the national judge in closing that investigation are still, I suppose, up for speculation. But in any case, they closed the case three investigation without there having been an investigation in the context of repeated statements by the Cambodian government that there would be no cases three and four. The international co-prosecutor, who is actually not the same person as was there when the cases were originally referred to the Office of Co-Investigating Judges, he raised a number of concerns about the case three investigation. And I think during the course of last year, the momentum around that issue built. Staff on the international side of that office, so lawyers, investigators and analysts, walked out, taking a stand because there hadn't been any genuine investigations. And eventually, the international judge resigned in October of last year. This actually sort of set off a number of interesting events that happened after that. The international judge had a reserve judge, and ordinarily he should have stepped straight into that position, but a number of things happened. The Cambodian government publicly rejected the appointment of that international judge. However, he did still come to Cambodia. The UN made a public statement at that time, which actually is early this year, saying that the Cambodian government was in breach of the agreement and that actually the substantive decision of judicial appointment of an international judge does not lie with the Cambodian government. Under the agreement, it is meant to be the UN who makes the substantive decision about who to send and who to be appointed. But there is a rubber stamp, if you like, mechanism within the agreement that the government then used to effectively block the appointment. Where things are at right now with that issue is that there's effectively an impasse between the UN and the Cambodian government. The UN says that the judge is effectively appointed under the agreement, and that while the rubber stamp from the government was preferable, it actually wasn't required. And the judge, Judge Kaspar Ansermay, his name is, who's from Switzerland, is currently in Cambodia trying to conduct investigations in those two cases. Right now, the fate of the cases, I think, is pretty unknown. But I suppose we'll see how things pan out during the course of this year. There are some very positive aspects, I think, to where things are at now. Under Judge Kaspar Ansermay's predecessor's authority, we were concerned that this court, with UN backing, was somehow going to be contributing to the whitewashing of some of the Khmer Rouge's alleged atrocities. And we were very concerned about that being part of this court's legacy. So at least now, the person who is in office is intending to conduct genuine investigations in both of those cases. And although we're hopeful about that, we'll see how much he can actually do that with minimal or no national cooperation. So that's the cases in a nutshell. I haven't really turned to the content of our report, although I've outlined some of the issues that definitely we've raised in there. I'm happy to hand it over now if you want to, and be guided by your questions for the next half an hour about what I've raised, and maybe I can explore the report a bit more through that.
I wonder, I'm going to start out, the moderator, if you could say a little bit more about what the resistance of the Cambodian government is to case 3 and 4, and also whether there's been an impact on case 2 of what's happening in case 3 and 4.
Yes, great. Well, the first thing is, as I said at the beginning, the Cambodian government's position is about national security. We don't actually think there is a lot of merit to that concern. I mean, the suspects in cases 3 and 4, whose names are meant to be confidential, they're actually very widely known in the public domain. They appear in many media reports, etc. And in fact, some of the judges in the pretrial chamber just released a document with the names of the suspects in case 3 in the public version of that document. Basically, these people are old, as are, you know, all of the people that the court could potentially be going after at this stage. But I think from all of the people that we speak with on the ground about what the real concerns are, I think it's really about political control. At least one of the suspects in cases 3 and 4 is currently a local commune official. Later this year, in June actually, there are commune elections and also next year national elections. I think there are concerns that actually what this is linked to is the government's hold on political power in the country in specific regions, rather than that there's suddenly going to be civil war if any of them are indicted. I think also it's about the government's ultimate control over this process. And you can actually see that, how it plays out in the court, because on politically charged questions, every national judge in the court has voted in line with the government's position. There has never been a decision from a national judge in the court that runs contrary to what the government actually wants in those cases. And really, when you get to the heart of this, it's about the court's independence. Now, on the second issue, case two, this is actually a really great question, because I think up until now, one thing I didn't mention is that the court, unlike the ICTR and ICTY, is funded by voluntary contributions from donor states. So it's always been a bit precarious in that respect. But I think there has been a lack of political will by the government, obviously, and by donors, well, at least ambivalence by donors and ambivalence by the UN to whether or not the court continues beyond case two. In relation, but the position always has been that we hear repeatedly is case two is the case against the surviving leadership of the Khmer Rouge. This is what's important. It's sort of a case two at all expense kind of philosophy. And, you know, in relation to that, the issue has also been that the issues with cases three and four are limited to cases three and four. That's actually not true, because many of the witnesses in cases two and one are also witnesses in case three. And what we repeatedly hear reports about now in the case three and four investigations is that when witnesses are being spoken to, they are recanting their statements, the statements that they originally gave to the co-prosecutors, and that this has resulted in giving rise to a number of disclosure obligations for the prosecutor in case two. Now, the impact of that, I think, remains to be seen right now. We don't know to what extent the defence will use that to challenge the credibility of those witnesses in case two. But potentially it's very problematic, I think, for case two, if the witnesses on whose evidence case two turns have credibility issues associated with their essential fear to maintain the line that they originally took on the case three or four suspects.
Yes.
Yeah, I had two questions, if I may. First of all, this has been a very informative presentation, so thank you.
Thank you.
My first question is about jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. And subject matter jurisdiction for national charges. Were any national laws even in effect during that time period?
This actually comes from, the national crimes come from, I think, the 1956 Penal Code. They were in force at the time. There have been some issues associated with the national crimes, though, because some of them, there's been an issue about whether they're time barred. Some of them have a 10-year statutory time limit. Really, the focus of the indictments has been the international crimes. Originally, obviously, it wasn't intended that way, but that's definitely how it's turned out. It really is genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes.
My next question is just, how is, case one has been finished, case two as well. How is this viewed by Cambodian society at large? Mm-hmm. Is it viewed as justice being done, a sense of closure to a terrible period, or is it viewed more ambivalently? Can you address those kinds of things?
Yeah, I mean, my answer to that would be that it's very mixed. I would say, I was actually talking about this yesterday because there is some data out there, actually collected by Berkeley, about the impact of the Khmer Rouge Tribunal. And I think overwhelmingly it was positive in both instances, data collected in 2008 and 2010. I think maybe around 86 to 87% that Cambodians thought this court was a good thing and that they wanted to see people brought to justice for the crimes. I think when you dig a little bit deeper, there are still some concerns, though, because from the same studies over the course of that period, 08 to 2010, the faith of Cambodians in certain aspects of the judicial system decreased. You know, for example, the stats increased about, you know, whether going to court meant paying bribes to judges, and whether senior government officials would still be subject to the law in Cambodia, just like ordinary citizens. The interesting thing about that, though, is the second lot of data was collected in 2010 in December, and that was before many of the events unfolded last year that I think caused a lot of damage to the reputation of the court. I'm not sure how well that message got out into Cambodian society of what was going on there. So we've actually spoken internally about that we would like to see some more data collected at this stage. Another important gauge of that, though, is, you know, one of the pioneering aspects to the Khmer Rouge Tribunal is its victims' participation. And I think about 90 civil parties joined to case one. Their views of the process were positive also. You know, at the end of case one trial, we said that Doig had got a fair trial. I think, though, you know, with the Doig case, it was largely uncontroversial in a lot of ways, especially politically. But we did say, nonetheless, at the end of the trial that he got a fair trial. I won't go into the appeal judgment. We do discuss that in our report because we raised some concerns about the appeal judgment undoing some of those findings, but I won't have time to go into it. But in case two, there are almost 4,000 civil parties joined to that case, a much huger group to manage for the court. So I think really we want to see what do they think about this process, and I think we'll be gauging that. You know, it's something we will be monitoring closely along the way. An important thing to highlight about case two is that other than being Tariq being severed from the case, they took a really important procedural decision at the beginning of the trial. The indictment is 700 pages long, and the decision they took was to break it into smaller mini trials. You know, the trial chamber is grappling with a lot of really complicated issues here. You know, defendants in their 80s, almost 4,000 civil parties joined to the proceedings. You've got scores of lawyers in the courtroom, etc. But and at the time that they severed the case into smaller pieces, we supported that in theory because the idea was hopefully the court would be able to get to some judgment before one or more of the accused died. But there are, of course, impacts on the civil parties because of that. For example, some individuals are joined to the proceedings on the basis of genocide allegations. You know, that they are ethnic Vietnamese who were targeted because of that, or Khmer Krom, etc., or Cham Muslim. And they won't get to those parts of the trial until further down the track. So it's definitely been some kind of, you know, balancing exercise and as I say, a big gauge of how things fare, I think, will be how engaged they ultimately feel and whether they feel like they got justice out of the process.
I was actually wondering if you could talk a little bit more about case two, because I know they're going through the documents right now. There's just been some, there's been some issues with that. So mm-hmm. in terms of the evidence that's in case two and how that's functioning now that it's broken up into smaller parts.
Yeah, well, when they opened the case in November, the co-prosecutors were directed to open the case in relation to the entirety of the allegations, and they did that, but, you know, the beginning of the trial, the first section of the trial is only about forced movement of the population out of Phnom Penh and any associated crimes with that forced movement of the population. The trial chamber did leave a small avenue open, though, for joining additional crimes from the rest of the indictment or additional allegations along the way if it felt that that was appropriate. But, of course, subject to making sure that the accused fair trial rights, you know, that they know what they're actually being tried for at the time. The documents issue, yes, you know, the majority of the documentation that the court has in its possession comes from an NGO called the Documentation Centre for Cambodia. And right now they've been going through all of those documents. They've had two separate weeks during the 7 weeks of the trial so far where they've done that. There have been challenges to those documents and challenges to the independence of the Documentation Centre of Cambodia. All of those issues are still live right now. So all I know is, like many of these trials at this senior level of leadership, the evidence is very documentation focused. Perhaps more than others I've seen, actually, because that documentation is available.
Another question I had for you, Claire, was given the movement of international justice to now focus on national systems' responsibility for prosecution of serious international crimes, you mentioned yesterday about the mm-hmm. sort of complementarity push.
Yeah.
What you know, what advice, what lessons learned do you have from this experiment that would be relevant to those who argue that we should be focused in that direction?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I agree with that focus. I think, you know, just comparing my experience from ICTR to Cambodia, you know, one of the positive things I've seen is the greater local engagement in the process that's taken place. With the Rwanda Tribunal that's situated in Tanzania, the greatest extent of Rwandan participation is really as witnesses in that process. And, you know, there has been a bit more outreach conducted in more recent times, but really there hasn't been, I think, that great engagement. Now, I think when you get to the heart of issues like judicial independence, etc., it's a lot more complicated. I mean, frankly, I think one of the lessons here is that given the precarious situation of judicial independence in Cambodia when the tribunal is set up, you simply can't have a majority of national judicial participation if you want to have those fundamental guarantees preserved. I've often thought about, actually, that you could maintain this structure. I don't know how this would work, but it's just a theory. But if this chamber was wholly international, that maybe some of this stuff could be overcome, and the issues around, well, criticisms of lack of independence because the national judges keep splitting along government lines. I should say that, you know, it was always expected that this would be the problem, and that's why these procedures were built in. But yeah, I don't know. I have thought that maybe if this was wholly international, you might be able to preserve indictments, etc., beyond the pretrial chamber. Then, of course, though, you still hit the issues in the trial chamber if the national judges then vote with the
and same to the Supreme Court.
Exactly.
So your suggestion is to sort of think about more carefully the makeup of the hybrid enterprise.
I think so. I mean, I know that the special court for Sierra Leone has had its own issues as well, but in that instance, you know, majority international judges. I think really if you want to preserve the integrity of the institution, this is really what's required, especially in precarious situations like this. I mean, it's well documented that there was next to no judicial independence in Cambodia when the court was set up, or at least really grave problems with it. So perhaps in other circumstances where that's not so much the case, you could proceed with this kind of model. But the advice given to the UN in the late 90s when the Cambodian government asked for this was this should be a wholly international enterprise or initiative, and it was precisely for these reasons that they advised that. So really I think the advice that I would give is no different to what that was back then. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just that it's now we've seen how some of this has played out. And
Yeah,
I read recently that the court needs money. Mm-hmm. $1 million from their funders.
Yeah.
And some employees haven't been paid for like 4 or 5 months. Or
yeah.
Like that.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about like how that happened and like the impact?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. So, as I was saying before, the court's based on voluntary contributions from donor states, and similar to the SCSL, but you know, the SCSL had its own management committee that maybe ironed out some of the. I mean, it ran out of money as well, but so the biggest donors for the court have been Japan, Australia, now the US. The United Kingdom and I think the EU, France also. The US government, for example, only contributes to the international side of the court, not to the national side of the court. And really the reasoning behind that is that back in 2007, OSJI raised corruption allegations about on the national side of the court about national staff members having to pay kickbacks sort of up the chain for their positions. And so the US government's an example of a donor country that only contributes to the international side of the operations. There are some donors who only contribute to the national side as well, though. For example, the German government funds the victim support section in the court, which is almost wholly national. I would say, you know, the budget situation with the court has been, you know, a major issue for it throughout its operations. But I think the most recent budgetary crises relate to what was happening last year, at least in part, you know, with the court's credibility, etc. Yeah, the national side hasn't been paid since October. There are all kinds of problems because of that. And actually, prior to October, there were 2 months, maybe July and August, where the national judges weren't paid at all. Right now, or even last week, there was a funding conference in New York, and since then there have been a number of pledges, I think to the tune of about 15 to 17 million. But the court's budget for this year and next year is around over $90 million. So, you know, they still got a ways to go. I think the establishment of a court this way, you know, with voluntary contributions, raises its own power dynamics as well, which can be good and bad. Again, you know, comparing to ICTR and ICTY, you know, they had a permanent budget, part of the United Nations budget, and so funding was assured. They still have had, you know, budgetary issues along the way, but nothing like this where you're relying on voluntary contributions. Donors, I think, then also have certain expectations about how things go, and their views play a lot into, you know, decision-making made at the highest levels about the court. And I think that can be good and bad. So, yeah, I think some more permanent funding when these things are conceived is necessary.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'd like to just come back to the lessons learned question. I'm thinking in the case of Rwanda in recent years, there was the development of these community groups that would assess confessions of perpetrators, mm-hmm. and the community would then make decisions on what would happen with these people.
Gachacha proceeding?
Should these kinds of informal methods be encouraged?
Yeah.
And if so, should that kind of an informal process be set up in conjunction with the establishment of a formal tribunal?
Yeah, you know, these questions I think are great ones because, you know, the thing I think about the ECCC, in terms of its positive legacy, some of these other things are happening. So I think it's created some spin-off effect. You know, there are NGOs, local NGOs, involved in other kinds of initiatives to recognize Khmer Rouge history and Khmer Rouge atrocities, and all of that is very important, actually. You know, it's complementary to strictly criminal proceedings. I can give one example of a very positive program, I think. You know, one of the criticisms of the Khmer Rouge Tribunal is that investigation and prosecution of crimes of sexual violence weren't prioritized, and you know, that's come up repeatedly. I think the position taken by the prosecutor's office has been that there were problems linking rapes, you know, to higher level officials, and there, at the same time, there were also policies that people who committed rape should be punished. So, but anyway, a local NGO in December of last year put together a two-day hearing presided over by a panel of four experts, two Cambodian, one Japanese, and one South Korean. It was a non-judicial panel. You know, there was no perpetrator in the dock. Indeed, the women that testified didn't know who the perpetrators were, but could identify them as Khmer Rouge cadres. And over the course of 2 days, you know, in a public forum, women heard, women testified to those atrocities, and the public heard that. And I think it was an incredibly important and successful initiative. So You know, the space for these kinds of initiatives, I think, has grown because of the Khmer Rouge Tribunal being there and attention being focused on Cambodia and, you know, Khmer Rouge history. There are lots of other things going on in terms of education and victim-perpetrator dialogues and So there's a lot of stuff going on, even on the very critical aspects of what the court's doing. I've heard a lot of people talk about the positive impact of this because, you know, human rights norms, etc., or observance of those is still very much growing. But by engaging in this kind of public dialogue about what a justice system is meant to look like and also where the court's coming up short, etc., I think you encourage critical thinking around that, and hopefully, long term, you have some impact on that.
I just want to do one follow-up, and then, unless there's another hand. Yeah, sorry.
Just wanted to know, these national co-prosecutors or co-investigating judges or sitting in the trial chambers, the Cambodian side, are they working full-time for the tribunal, or they are holding their positions within the Cambodian judiciary and coming there as and when needed?
Their positions are full-time in the court, but they also still hold office in the national judicial system. And this is something that's been raised, you know, in terms of conflict, etc. But, for example, the national co-investigating judge is also the president of the Court of Appeal, and he effectively holds both offices and, you know, has some caseload, I think, in both institutions. So, yeah.
And anybody else? The last question I had just relates to the earlier comment. You spoke a little bit about victim participation. The idea of 4,000 people participating as civil parties in case number 2 shows an incredible amount of interest and positive effect of the institution, on the other hand, there's been some very vocal participants that have expressed deep disappointment about the process of participation in these tribunals. And so I wonder, kind of in the context of looking at complementary to criminal strict criminal proceedings, what you think on balance of the victim participation scheme at the ECC, you know, in terms also of lessons learned?
Yeah. I think a few things about that. You know, I think with the DOIC case, it was much more manageable. The participation was much smaller, but then the scope of DOIC's crimes were very limited to two facilities. So, you know, I think their involvement in the process was generally positive. But there was, I think there's one disappointing part of the DOIC judgment legacy for victim participation, and that's the court, the trial chamber, and then it was upheld on appeal in terms of the scope of the reparations that they could order. Really, the only thing to come out of it is that they compiled all of DOIC's apologies and you know, posted it on the tribunal's website, and I think are putting together some kind of publication that they would take out into the provinces about that. The court hasn't wanted to go into any discussion about reparations that would require government coercion, and I think that is unfortunate. You know, whether or not certain orders could be enforced, I think symbolically it would be good to see the court, you know, have taken a bit of a more creative stand on that, but that hasn't happened. In terms of case 2, I think the participation's going to be even more symbolic again. With the DOIC case, those civil parties were at the court a lot for the trial. For case two, that's not going to be possible. In fact, I heard that, you know, the intention is for every civil party to be able to go to the court at least once to see what's happening. So the real engagement by civil parties in the proceedings, I think, is going to be a lot more limited than just because of the number. I think also, you know, they, after DOIC, they devised a different system for civil party representation where rather than having a number of lawyers representing the interests in the courtroom, they now have two, one national and one international, representing those interests. And yeah, it's largely symbolic. I think the complaints coming from civil party lawyers I've spoken with is, you know, that the process is too symbolic and that it's hard for them to, you know, get a platform to actually convince the court to do this or that or, you know, deliver some kind of more substantive justice. But when they re-devised the scheme, they added some provision for a thing called non-judicial measures. And these are non-court-ordered measures. So some of the programs I've spoken about that NGOs are already engaged in could be taken up by the court and maybe given some more momentum because they're affiliated with the court. So there are lots of other ways, I think, that victims, you know, can see broader justice through the court, or at least maybe stamped by the court in some way, even if it's only by the victim's support section. In our most recent report, actually, because of that, because of the responsibility now on the victim support section to deliver this kind of thing, we asked for more international involvement in the decision making about that, because I think despite its mandate, there have only been very limited developments with it.
It really speaks to the investment in that as opposed to the participation scheme alone.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, help me, join me in thanking Claire Duffy for her incredible insights.